Jody Crumpy, director of the Erie City Mission Thrift Stores and Donation Center. When you shop at one of our two thrift stores or drop off items at our donation center, you are providing a meal. You are housing a man in our shelter, helping men and women overcome addiction, and giving our inner city youth an opportunity to learn. I want to thank you for making a difference. This is our city, our mission. God bless you.
All year round, Frontier Home Products and Design has what you need to make your home comfortable and beautiful. Relax on a new timber tech deck designed by Frontier's experts. A new fireplace from Frontier Home Products Fireplace Gallery adds warmth and serenity to any home. Beauty and versatility at Frontier Home Products and Design Center, 4213 Peachtree, 5th, next to the Bayfront Highway.
Frontier Home Products and Design Center. Discover a new frontier.
PA contractor number PA039007.
Welcome to TalkErie.com's Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast. Every day, we tackle the biggest issues that the Erie, PA region faces. Stay informed and involved as we advance the narrative of Erie. Now, here's Joel Natale.
I want to welcome to our microphone and I'm just so excited about this conversation. Bishop Curtis L. Jones, Sr., he is the co-founder and director of the Historical Institute of Culture and the African-American Experience, also owner of Chippers. What is it, Chippers Seafood Fusion?
Seafood and Southern Fusion.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good, right? Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you coming on.
I appreciate you having me here as well, Joel.
You know, let's get a little bit of your origin story. Did you grow up here, Bishop, or did you move in, or your family move in from somewhere else?
Actually, I was raised here. I came to Erie when I was at the age of 3 years old. I'll be 69 on April 1st, so the majority of my life has been here in Erie, on the lower west side, actually.
That's amazing. And were you necessarily in the Jerusalem neighborhood back then, or?
I was. Actually, I lived at 221 Walnut Street.
221,
right,
wow.
Right in the heart of New Jerusalem. Didn't know it was New Jerusalem then, though.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, we didn't really know a lot of the African-American history coming up, right? I mean, you're a little bit older than me, but not that much, you know?
Yeah, and then we were children, and we didn't know what the adults were going through. So, you know, it was just home for us.
Okay, sure. Wow. Talk about, like when you became kind of aware, was that in the 60s? I mean, would you, like, what era do you feel like you became kind of aware of kind of the lay of the land, if you will?
I'm like a late bloomer.
Okay.
So I would say maybe 80s.
Oh.
Yeah, I went through high school, and actually I went to Burns Elementary, and then I went from there to Gritley.
Okay.
And the following year, I was supposed to be going to Strong Vincent.
Yeah.
Between that time, I moved to California, to Pasadena, and went to high school in Pasadena. After I graduated, came back to Erie.
Yeah.
And so a lot of segregation and those things did not really register because out west is a little bit more fast-paced than Erie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so when I came back to Erie, I'm like, you guys are doing things we were doing 3 or 4 years ago.
Little bit behind, huh?
Yeah, sort of behind. So
was Pasadena kind of multicultural? I mean, was it kind of a cool vibe as a teenager?
Yeah, yeah, actually it was. Pasadena was really a really diverse community. Mm-hmm. We were only 17 miles from L.A.
Yeah.
So we got the overflow from L.A. with people from always coming into Pasadena from L.A. So it was a great experience. I would definitely do that experience again.
Yeah, that kind of that boomerang experience, even as a young person like you were, mm-hmm. you really do get a sense, okay, yeah, things are done a little different. You know, maybe we can bring back some of the best practices back to our hometown.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And actually, I'm excited about what we have established or in the process of establishing. You know, by going away and seeing other things, you get ideas mm-hmm. and you get dreams that you would like to see implemented in your city. I think the African American Museum is one. The restaurant is another. And we're working on another project that we think that would be a good fit for the city as well.
Wonderful. All right. So did you jump right into ministry, or did you do something else, get into ministry, and now you're into this entrepreneurship stuff? Talk about kind of that thread, if you will.
Actually, when I came back from Pasadena, my wife and I, which my wife and I were sweethearts in elementary school. So it's one of those stories, you know.
Yeah, I love it.
And so when I came back, I was 19. She was 18. We got married. And so we sort of just belonged to the church, and I was sort of a behind-the-scenes guy. I did the finances for the church. I'd kept the books and all that type of thing. So I was a finance guy, so I was really not in the public in the public view a lot. So as we moved on to another ministry, then I began to become more involved in the spiritual aspect of the ministry, even to the point where I became a pastor, and then from a pastor to an overseer, and then from an overseer to now where I am a bishop.
Amazing. I want you to talk about raising kids. Because, I mean, if somebody knows the Jones family, these are a bunch of high-capacity people. You know, I'm thinking about Curtis Jr. I think about Mike. I mean, these are people that I know that are just amazingly talented, thoughtful, like I said, high capacity. They have broad shoulders. They could take on a lot of stuff. And those are only the kids that you have that I know. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Joe, and again, I'm very fortunate. And I don't mean I mean my wife and I. Yeah. Are very fortunate to have had 14 children.
Wow.
We have 13 living, and we lost one at crib death. He was 3 months old. But when we had gotten married, as soon as we got married, we both wanted a large and agreed to a large family. We had, we had 8 boys in a row. Then we had 4 girls in a row. We're like, where are those girls at?
Where did they come from?
And then here come the girls.
Wow.
So we had 4 girls in a row, and then we had a boy and a girl.
Amazing.
So again, they all are doing very well. We've been very fortunate and very blessed to have them all doing well. I say Curtis Jr., he works for the Chamber now. Yeah. My son Kevin, he's a barber. He's in Atlanta. He's doing well in Atlanta. You mentioned Mike. Mike is in South Carolina now. His son is actually one of the premier basketball players down in South Carolina.
Yeah.
As a sophomore, he's already broken his school record and moving on to the state record. So he has 2 more years to go.
And he's still in high school,
and
right?
He's a sophomore in high school.
Wow.
Yeah. And then
Mike is like an off-the-chain keyboard player.
Amazing.
To get into a worship service or any kind of a concert with Mike Jones, you just get your socks knocked off.
Yeah, you know? That's his passion. He loves that, and he's been doing that for the majority of his life, and he's just getting better and better with that.
Wow.
So again, very fortunate to have a very amazing family, and the city of Erie has been great to our family, and doors have just opened for them, and we're very thankful for that.
What as a dad, what is the, and I know we're getting there, right?
Yeah,
but I think there's something to be said about how you conduct yourself and what your core values are. What is your primary value as a father?
My primary value as a father is to be honest and hold to your integrity. I would like to think that I'm a man of integrity, and I try to portray that and instill that in my children. Not only talk to them about it, but I try to live and be an example of a man of integrity. And if you say something, you know, if it hurts you to do it, it hurts. But you got to own up to your word, because there was a time, as you know, your word was your bond.
Yeah.
If you said it, people were expecting you to do it. And so I tried my best. Hopefully I succeeded instilling that in my sons and my daughters, that if you say something, you know, be of integrity, hold that integrity, and then instill that into your children as well.
Have you felt that as you've grown older, that culture is coming in and challenging your values?
Absolutely. The culture that we live in now is a completely different culture that I was raised in and that I raised my children in. The culture that we're in now, I'm sort of on the outside. It's a little different because I still hold to my values. I still hold to the time that I was raised. And it's sort of difficult to see how society is changing. You know, it's completely different. The children are different. Everything is different from the time where we were coming up. So it's just, but it's still a thing that you still hold on to. You know, even when things aren't the way you want to or you expect them to be, you still hold to your integrity and you still keep your word. So that never changes.
Say amen to that. I'm interested because, like, you're like the right age that you could have been, you know, part of the 60s, like the 60s movement. But you were an accountant. I mean, did you miss the 60s?
I did not miss the 60s. I did have a couple of experiences in the 60s. I was born in 55 in Memphis. I'm actually originally from Memphis, Tennessee. And so I was born in 55. I came to Erie when I was 3, so I was 58. So, and I got some of the 60s and some of the experiences that I did have with segregation is that we would go down south every year. And to Arkansas, and we had family there, and they still had schools. The black students went to this school, and the white students went to this school. And this was probably I was 16, so that was probably in the mid to late 60s. And it's just the way it was back then. So that was the
only... Boston had it too, though.
But I never been to Boston.
No, but I mean, like, you think about it, you know, again, the enlightened North, right?
Yes.
Boston had to have busing because they were still segregating their schools. And I can't remember. Maybe you could tell me the story of Erie. Did we have segregated schools so much or not really?
I never experienced it.
No.
I never experienced it. And that's why it sort of stood out to me when I went to Arkansas because I've never seen this up north.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Burns and it was a diverse group of people. I went to Gridley. It was diverse. And, you know, so when I saw this, I'm like, what's going on here? You know, and it was a culture shock.
Sure.
It was a culture shock.
Do you remember? Because I kind of do, and I was real little. Mm-hmm. I was 6 when Martin Luther King Jr. died. You know, when he was shot, and that was an incredible shock to our community and to our country. You know?
Absolutely, I remember that as well, Joe. I think that was in '68.
Yeah,
and so I was 13. You know, I was 13 years old, so I was at Burns School, and when we heard that, and as a matter of fact, I might have been in Mr. Sennett. The Mayor Sennett, his dad was a school teacher at Burns, and he was my 6th grade teacher. And so I think it was during that grade, either the 5th or that grade, that he was shot. And in the community that I live in, it was... people just lost it, so to speak, for lack of a better word or better terms. And there was rioting, and there was, even in the schools, they were just people were just angry. Yeah. It was an angry time
it definitely reached into Erie.
It definitely reached into
the trauma of all of that.
Yeah, and the thing about that, Joe, again, because I was so young, I didn't get the magnitude of it that maybe the older, the adults did.
Yeah.
So they were looking at it from a whole different perspective. I was looking at it from a perspective of a teenager, a young teenager, and I just saw the results of it. Of the backlash from it, but the adults who actually lived that, I'm sure it was more difficult for them.
Do you think that for African Americans of that time, and for years after, it took a long time to regain trust that you know that the message of Dr. King would live on? I mean, of nonviolence, of loving your neighbor, of having a dream.
Yeah, I think that speaks volumes, and I think that will remain. I think it was just when he was shot, it was just a time of up evil or whatever.
Yeah,
not for a better word.
It just turned
things upside down. I think when things begin, it took some time.
Yeah.
It took some time for things to settle down, but I think it got back to his to his belief, to his passion, which was nonviolence. And quite naturally, you're going to always have those who don't believe that philosophy, but I believe that philosophy is still applicable today.
Okay, so in your career, you're kind of cruising. You're a pastor. You're mm-hmm. you're doing your thing. Were you bivocational, or did you just do the church?
I was bivocational because I actually had jobs throughout. Raising my children.
Yeah,
I worked
yeah.
for GE. I worked okay. for different companies. And actually, I worked for the Department of Corrections. I was a chaplain at the Department of Corrections.
Nice,
that's
yeah.
where I retired from.
Okay.
I did.
Did you go to Albion? Or
I worked at Albion.
Okay.
I was a Protestant chaplain at SCI Albion.
Yeah. I remember years and years ago, mm-hmm. I was part of a praise band, and we performed, did a worship service at Albion.
Yeah, I may have been there at that time.
You probably were. It took an hour to get from the front gate to the chapel.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, multiple
security.
Layers of security. Yeah. We had to have we had to have all the paperwork, all the T's crossed and I's dotted, right? But it's a secure location. But I tell you what, we had a beautiful service, packed house.
Absolutely.
You know, really
very
amazing.
Passionate. They are.
I remember remarking that I said, you know, if I didn't know I was incarcerated in a prison, I could have seen any one of these people with a 3-piece suit working for PNC Bank or working for Erie Insurance. I mean, they were beautiful people.
Absolutely.
You know, but they made mistakes.
They made mistakes, and like we tell people, you know, some of your best musicians, some of your best singers, some of your best whatever are in prison, you know. And so they're very well-mannered. You know, quite naturally, you're going to have that, you know, that one knucklehead, you know.
Yeah, sure.
But as a whole, they were very well-mannered. They were very respectful. And I'm sure you experienced that when you went in there.
Again, they knew it was a privilege to come to chapel.
Exactly.
So
it was something that they didn't want to lose that privilege.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, all right. So you fast forward, you retired from the Department of Corrections, and you get in your head, you want to start a restaurant. And we're talking about Chippers. Yeah.
We're talking about Chippers Seafood and Southern Fusion. That was an idea that we've had maybe 10 to 12 years before we actually came to be.
Is this something that you guys would make at home, some of these dishes?
Well, actually, a friend of mine actually had a restaurant. And so we got some of the ideas from him, and we just sort of refined them. And, you know, just like anything else, you see, you can always improve it.
And it's a family affair, right? Your daughters are involved.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, talk about it.
Actually, my daughter, Valencia, she sort of runs the restaurant for us. She manages it for us. Although we did put a lot of time in it in initially getting it ready and getting it off the ground. And then when my wife and I were able to do that, we turned it over to Valencia, and she's running it, managing it for us now. My wife, she still goes in periodically and does the sides every morning. The sides are fresh every day.
Wow.
And it's the toughest thing, one of the toughest things for us was finding staff. And especially because, you know, we opened really right in the middle of COVID.
Yeah, you sure did.
Yeah. COVID hit like in May, April, mm-hmm. and we opened in August.
Oh, my.
And the thing about it, the city of Erie I've always praised the city of Erie because they were so receptive and so responsive that we had lines out the door and around the corner in COVID. I mean, and no one could come in and sit down. They had to take it and go.
It was all takeout.
Everything was takeout. So we, you know, Erie has really supported us, and they still are, even up until this day.
Well, I was going to say you've had so much support that you were able to take over the space, almost doubling your space, right?
Correct. I mean, actually, it's more space.
It is more space.
It's more space in the area next door, which we had to, which is complete now. We had to open up a wall. Because it was two separate properties or two separate lots, and so we were able to went through the process to be able to do that. It's an amazing. We think it's an amazing facility. Somebody said it's a sad frog that doesn't praise his own pond, you know. So it's ready. We rented it out a few times. We have a stage in there. We have extended dining, and then we have a special area that groups can rent out as well.
Yeah, and so on heavy nights, you're just going to go and see people in for the restaurant, or is it going to be more for private kind of concerns, do you think?
Well, at this point, either or. It could be being rented out for private use.
Yeah.
But the idea was initially to have extended seating with live music periodically on the Fridays and Saturdays. Nice. We're looking at doing live music, whether it be jazz or just something different for the downtown area that we're adding to the downtown area. So, again, we're looking not just seating, but we want to, again, have the live music and just sort of, again, the facility is available for rent as well.
Do you get a sense that your location and some of the other things that are happening north of the tracks, that there's some synergy going on there that's going to benefit everybody in that neck of the woods there?
I really do. I think we're in a great location. I mean, the location that we are in downtown Erie, I don't think we could have asked for a greater location. It is so much activity that's taking place. As we know, a lot of it is geared, is focused on down here in this area.
North of the park.
Of the park. Yeah. But everything is moving up that direction.
Oh, yeah. 10th and State right now is hopping.
It really is. And so we're right in the heart of that. So, and we've seen the benefit of it, actually. And so, again, we think we're in a great location, and we want to offer a good product. We want to offer an excellent product, and we just want to offer an excellent atmosphere that people can come and feel safe and just have a good time.
Okay, I want to ask you a chicken or the egg question here. In the new space at Chippers, you have a mural, a timeline of African-American history here in Erie. Did that come out of the building of the African-American experience or before? Which is the chicken or the egg?
Well, it actually came before.
It did?
It actually came before. And that mural, I think, goes from the mid-1770 or 80 up until 2014. And it's a lot of Erie history. It's a lot of firsts. It's the first African-American church. It's the first African-American funeral home. It's when GCAT got started, when Ben Wiley's first opened. So it's a great timeline, the Pope Hotel. So yeah. It's just a lot of great information, and it's all local African-American history.
We spent a first half hour kind of getting your story and the lead-in to the creation of this institute. And talk about where the idea came from to do this.
Okay, the idea came from, again, we had mentioned before about a spark. You know, when we had put the timeline up in the restaurant, that it just sort of sparked something within us. And so we, my son, actually, I'll be transparent and frank. My son, Kurt, and I were in the facility one afternoon. And my wife and I and one of my sons, we live there. It's 35 rooms in that building.
This is the old rectory of St. Mary's Church.
That's correct. This is
35. Who lived there?
The priests.
See, they must have had a lot of priests.
At one time, they really did. At one time, I think all, you know, when the Catholic Church was really moving and it was just a lot. So they were able to fill that facility.
I wonder if some of the Gannon priests might have lived there.
Could have. I have history. One of the archivists has given me a lot of history, and Bishop Gannon was. Okay. I don't know if he lived there personally,
right,
but a lot of
maybe a lot of the
a
priests,
lot of information was, they're concerning
that
him.
Seems, I mean, it seems more like a dormitory than anything else, you know.
Yeah, the rooms are nice. The rooms are really nice.
Yeah.
The rooms are really nice. Again, there's 14 bedrooms in there.
Amazing.
Seven on the second, seven on the third floor. Again, 35 rooms, 9,700 square feet. So it's just me, my wife, or should I say my wife and I and my son.
Yeah.
We're the only ones living there. And we're like, how can we best utilize this facility? We're not using it to its best quality. What can we do?
And this is the home base of your church has been for, you know, 6 years or more, right?
Yeah, actually we purchased the property a little over 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And the church also is 9,700 square feet. It was built in 1854.
Wow.
And so the buildings connect. There's a hallways that connect the two buildings.
And this is St. Mary's on 9th Street.
Yeah, St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church. Yeah. It was actually one of the first you know, I don't know if I should share this story or not, but St. Mary's and St. Pat's, they used to go at it quite a bit.
Did they really? Yeah. They're competitive?
They'd be competitive, and the competitiveness came in with St. Patrick's claims to be the first Catholic church here. And St. Mary's, they say, well, we had the building that was bigger than you guys. And which was recognized by the bishop.
Well, and the story that I heard is that they built St. Patrick's thinking that would be the cathedral, and then they ended up Bishop Mullen or somebody built. Wasn't it Mullen's Folly or something like
somebody,
that?
He came and said, that's a nice building, but
I'm
he didn't recognize
a bigger one.
Exactly, which happened to be St. Mary's. So they go back and forth. They go back and forth.
That's funny.
So, again, a beautiful building.
Yeah.
Still, the structure inside and out is just immaculate. Mm-hmm. And so the property next to it, which is connected, which is a rectory, is, again, we say, how can we better utilize this facility? And Kurt and I were actually standing in the hallway. I said, Kurt, wouldn't this be amazing if this was an African-American museum?
Wow.
He's like, Dad, that's a great idea. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's a great idea, but that's all it is, you know. And that was the end of it. Mm. And then maybe a month or two later, it kept coming up, bubbling up. Like, Kurt, what do you think? What do you think it would take to make this something that, you know, because, and we start talking, you know, this is something that Erie doesn't have. It's something I think that Erie needs. I think it's something that Erie could benefit from. It would give knowledge. It would give information. And so we sort of went to our board and presented it to the board, and they said, that's a great idea. You guys have our approval. Move forward with it. Mm. And so at that point, we started moving forward, my wife and I. And we opened up, we started out as a, just with an art show.
Sure.
During Juneteenth of last year, we started out with an art show. So Mabel Howard, she is our curator for the art. And so she put a call out to some local artists, and they began to, the response was overwhelming, to the point where we had to turn artists away. Because at that particular point, we didn't have the space. We were only using the first floor, starting out there. And so we got some amazing, amazing artwork. I didn't realize there were so many artists and talented people of African-American descent who were here.
Yeah.
You know, and then for them to have a place that can be that can display their work. That is strictly, I shouldn't say strictly, because and I will hopefully get into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
But a place where they can display their work, and not only display their work, but their work is also available for sale.
Gotcha.
So it's a benefit to them.
Do you see that synergy of contemporary art, you know, from living artists, and the history? I mean, that seems like that would, that really, it almost, it leans forward to, hey, this is always going to be a living place. Whereas if you're just solely into history, it could get stale if you're not careful, right?
That's the challenge.
Yeah.
That's the challenge. And again, because we're not just doing art, we're doing history.
Yeah.
So we you know, she's a curator for the art, so she generates, keeps our art fresh, keeps the shows fresh. And then the artifacts, is that's more of a, I think, more of a challenge, the history piece, because it is so much history, and then we're just sort of highlighting certain points of history, so we have to keep that rotated to keep that history fresh. The African-American contributions to society is unimaginable. You wouldn't think the inventions that African-Americans have contributed, things such as a traffic light, the post office box, a saddle, not necessarily the saddle per se, but an invention to the saddle. And so that's just a few things.
Kurt Jr. Had out a plasma machine that he was demonstrating today at Erie Insurance.
At Erie Insurance. Actually, him and my wife were there, and they had a display of Otis, Otis Boykin. He is inventor of or discovered plasma, and then so he's giving credit for that. And so they were just displaying that as one of the inventions of African American.
Wow. So you're having to curate that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a decent sized cohort of African American historians in town. What's been their response to this effort?
Well, very, very positive. Very positive. Mr. Johnny Johnson, he is actually on our advisory board, and he's giving us, along with the other advisory board, are giving us some direction on how to move forward. And so we're excited about that. Just a lot going on, Joel.
Sure.
And, you know, our next step, actually our this particular show, which opened in October, is actually ending today.
Oh.
And so we'll be shutting down for 2 weeks at the museum. Then we'll be opening up March 14th for Women's History Month.
Okay, and so you're going to be displaying some women art and so on?
We're going to be displaying some. Actually, there are three African artists.
Oh.
I'm not artist, but designers, clothes designers, and they're in the process of already making outfits to be able to be on display. On the 14th, we will actually have live models of those African outfits, and then they will also make additional outfits to be on display at the museum for the rest of that show.
That's neat. And you know, of course, you have the major African-American holiday. So you started on Juneteenth. I would imagine you're gearing up for that and so on. Talk about some of those key highlights during the year.
The key highlights, particularly for that show, was, again, it was mainly art. It was a lot of art. As a matter of fact, it was only art. And so we were like, well, how can we expand, or when do we begin to expand to the second floor and begin to incorporate these bedrooms as exhibit rooms? And so from June to October, we got them done.
Wow.
You know,
that's fast.
And that's very fast. And we went online and looking for mailboxes, getting them shipped in, 70-pound mailboxes, getting them shipped in, you know, getting a traffic light, which the city of Erie donated a traffic light to us. It's operable, and it's one of the highlights when people come in to see it. I don't want to give away all the secrets.
No, we have to go through it.
Absolutely. Know. But, it took that length of time to be able to put those rooms together.
So how do hours work? What's the admission cost and all that kind of thing?
Okay, the hours are at right now, because we don't have a lot of volunteers. Mm-hmm. We're only open one day a week, which is Wednesday, 11 to 5. Or by appointment, but that's the day it's open to the public, 11 to 5 every Wednesday. There is no charge for the museum. Again, or by appointment, you can call and say, hey, Bishop, can I bring a group in and on this day and time? And we're open to that.
Do you have like a tip box or a
donation box? We have a donation box. Yeah,
okay,
we have a donation box and envelope. So we are accepting donations, but there is no charge to enter the museum.
Are you thinking that you're going to, now that you are almost a year in, you're going to get on like the directories and the maps, you know, because we're getting a lot of people for the eclipse, but we get a lot of people all summer long.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine that anyone interested in African-American history is going to want to seek this place out, you know?
Right. And Joe, excuse me. And that's one of the reasons why we at this point are allowing it to be free without a charge. Because we want people to come and see what is here. And maybe in seeing that will support that. That's one reason why it's free. As we move forward, we are working with a company that is putting together our strategic plan and those fundraiser and events and those type of things. So that work is in process. So, but again, we just want people to come down and see and hopefully they'll be proud of this particular piece that Erie is venturing out into. We hope to one day be on the different maps here's one of the locations you can come by. So we hope as we move forward that those things will be in place as well.
Bishop Curtis Jones Sr. is our guest here. We're talking about the Historical Institute of Culture and the African-American Experience. You don't start a project like this without having a passion for it yourself. And I'm wondering, like, what about African-American history, both in Erie and maybe across the board, has fascinated you the most?
Well, Joe, like I think I'd mentioned earlier that I was a late bloomer. And so when I began to see, because I played a lot of baseball when I was young. I played Erie boys baseball. Bud Elwell was one of my coaches.
Seriously.
Ben Wiley was one of my coaches. So, you know, these men had such an impact in my life. And then to see Mr. Wiley open up a GCAC or, you know, a GDIC. And as a child, you don't know that. You don't know how important or how, you know, adults are. But as time went on, I seemed like he actually making a difference. He's making a difference.
So really the
city.
Personalities, the people.
The people inspired me to, you know, and again, I was young. I didn't know, but they inspired me they can make a difference. Mm-hmm. You can make a difference depending on what you're offering to people.
Right.
And so we're like, we can make a difference on offering, I think, something Erie may have lacked, which is African-American knowledge and history, and having it in a location where you can come and see it. And that was a passion to me. One thing, I'm not an artist per se, but I am a photographer.
Oh.
I did photography for years. I covered the GCAC dinners for years. I was actually the Erie International Airport official photographer.
Nice.
When they did the runway extension. So I do have a passion for art.
Now, that's super cool. The I noticed, like, I'm seeing a picture here of, again, I'm seeing a picture of Harry T. Burley and seeing a picture of Ben Wiley. And again, it's going to take me to go visit all the people that you point out. But along the way, and I'm wondering if there's, natural dividing lines or whatever, but when you think about, as African-American leaders rose up into politics, into education, into the health systems and things, the Erie's first black doctor and so on. I mean, these are all trailblazers.
These are trailblazers. and Joel, what we want to do is sort of showcase that.
Yeah.
Erie has a lot of firsts. There's a lot of firsts just in African-American history. We're displaying that in the museum. One of the things that of African, one of the first is the first African-American four-star general in the Marines. The first female African-American female who was in charge of a naval vessel.
Oh, wow.
We're looking at the first deep sea diver. They made a movie of him.
Oh my!
And so it's just a lot of firsts that we're highlighting.
They say a lot of African Americans were part of Perry's fleet that battled in the Battle of Lake Erie.
Absolutely.
I mean, they were in the battle. Man.
There's a story that they tell, and I don't know how true it is because I wasn't there.
Right. 1813, right?
There you go, before my time. But they were saying that he was very proud. Initially, I guess he maybe wasn't encouraged to have him come aboard.
Yeah.
But as they did, and he worked with them, he was very proud of the team that he had of African Americans.
Well, it occurs
sailors.
To me, absolutely, it occurs to me that Erie's African American history in Erie is Erie's history, right?
Correct.
So the parallels of what our community went through, African Americans throughout history were feeling the same thing. So when JFK comes to the Hotel Lawrence, there are a bunch of Kennedy lovers in the crowd at 10th and Peach.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a collective lived experience.
It is. And I think it's a collective living experience that is continuing.
100%.
100%. It's continuing.
Yeah.
And Joel, let me, all we're trying to do here at the African American, the Historical Institute of Culture and the African American Experience, is just to showcase some history.
Mm-hmm.
We're just trying to give some knowledge. We're just trying to say, hey, I didn't know that. That's interesting, And so that's all we're trying to do is sort of showcase that. I like to sort of highlight and break the name down of the Historical Institute of Culture. People think that's just an African American museum. No, it's really not. It's a cultural center where we'll be dealing with all types of cultures. So we'll be dealing with the Latino culture. We'll be dealing with the Native American culture. We'll be dealing with the Italian culture. We'll be dealing with the Irish culture, the Scotland, just different cultures because it's cultures who make people who they are. And so we're just bringing an attention to the African-American culture. It's just sort of highlighting that. But we will have other cultures in that facility, and we're just having it an African-American experience.
I mean, again, kids that grow up in Erie, like you and I have done.
Yeah.
I wasn't super aware of, I just knew I had a lot of different friends. Maybe there was the Irish kid and the Italian kid and the black kid. I mean, it was just, we hung out together.
It was our neighborhood.
That's exactly
right. It didn't matter. We were friends. We played baseball together. We picked up Baseball games at 2nd and Bayview. I mean, 2nd and Walnut. We played basketball at 2nd and Walnut. I mean, it didn't matter. If you were good, you were on my team. It didn't matter.
I was always the one that was last picked. I'm sorry.
But you were on somebody's team, right?
Begrudgingly. Oh, my gosh.
But it didn't matter.
No, you're right.
Because
you're
that's neighborhood, and it didn't matter. We were friends, and you had my back. I had your back. And, you know, as time went on, we sort of go our separate ways, and we learned different things, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I really salute you and the efforts of your team, you know, in putting this together, because I think it is filling a gap, you know, and it's – you know, like we were saying off the air, I don't remember hearing much any African American. You heard the major stories, but not necessarily. And so I think the kids are in a better place where they're getting a more rounded approach to American history. Mm-hmm. But I love the whole idea of Erie history, of Erie. And, you know, again, you think I'm interested in knowing if you guys are going to cover or somebody. The newspaper recently did a couple stories about that people bridge from Laurel, Mississippi to Erie, Pennsylvania.
That migration.
That great migration.
Great migration. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think about it, and it almost makes me emotional. But Erie was the promised land, not only for kids from Laurel. But from my parents, from eastern Pennsylvania and the coal mines, they got that's a pretty stark future that, I'm going to go work in the coal mines. Or I can go work in advanced manufacturing in Erie, Pennsylvania, whether it's at the GE or at Lord or at Bucyrus Erie.
Wow.
And any, you think about it.
Yeah.
People came from all over.
You know, Joe, Erie has a lot of rich history. And I think we have overlooked it. It's full of history, not just African-American history, but history, period. Erie is full of it. Why can't we highlight our own history and be proud of the migration from the South or from Boston or your parents or from the coal mines? Erie is full of history. If we don't share the history, we'll lose it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one reason why we have the Historical Society. We want to preserve history, and because it is rich. And then we're just sort of highlighting local history because Erie is so full of rich history. That being said, too, we're just finishing up with the Erie School District. We've taken almost 2,000 children, 5th, 7th, and 9th graders through the museum the last 7 days. The feedback from them, they're excited. They did not know. It inspires them. If this can inspire them, then we feel as though we've accomplished our goal. And it is an amazing to see them react as they come back through the tours. And the last thing that I'm going to say, Joel, unless you ask me something else, is that one of the military rooms, we have a Tuskegee Airman who lives in Erie.
Wow.
And we have an exhibit dedicated to him. He's given us artifacts. He's the last living Tuskegee Airman from Rhode Island. So he has given us a lot of his artifacts, and we're in honoring him. We have a display just in honor of that Tuskegee Airman.
Wow. Again, a true hero.
Again, history that's rich that people didn't know.
No.
You know, but there's actually a Tuskegee Airman here in the city of Erie.
Thank you so much. Bishop Curtis Jones Sr., co-founder and director of the Historical Institute of Culture and the African American Experience.
You've been listening to The Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast from TalkErie.com. Subscribe to our show on your favorite podcatcher and get involved by emailing joel@TalkErie.com.